Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Friday, January 13th. Today, it's Friday, which means Sun writer Kevin Simpson will point you toward your weekend with something a little different. This week, he chats with award-winning Colorado author Mark Stevens. Before we begin, we're excited to present the next food revolution, Growing Greens in the Air, with environment reporter Michael Booth. Join the virtual event on February 9th to hear how one local company is using a storage container to grow crops, how CU Boulder is growing greens in a sunroom, and much more. Register for the free event at coloradosun.com/events. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. Attorney William Anderson met with Frederick Bonfils and Harry Tamman, owners of the Denver Post, in their office on 16th Street in downtown Denver on this day in 1900. What started as a conversation about securing the release of convicted cannibal Alfred Packer nearly transformed into a double homicide when an argument about legal tactics escalated and Anderson shot both owners. Bonfils and Tamman survived, but the episode reflected the chaotic and scandalous nature of the Post's early years. Newspapers flourished in the late 1800s as the most prolific and popular means of mass communication. The Rocky Mountain News, founded in 1859, dominated Denver as the oldest and most respected newspaper for decades, although it faced serious competition from several daily and weekly challengers. A newspaper called The Post debuted in 1892, but closed the following year as the Panic of 1893 led to a decline in advertisers and subscriptions. 2 years later, Bonfils and Tamman, purveyors of tacky souvenirs and promoters of circuses and lotteries, bought the resurrected Post and published their first issue on October 28, 1895. The paper specialized in sensational local gossip. As Bonfils stated, quote, "A dogfight on 16th Street is a better story than a war in Timbuktu." The Post gained readership through its emphasis on scandal, mixed with the occasional valid news story. Ownership of the paper passed to Helen Bonfils in 1930 upon her father's death. Tamman had died childless in 1924. The new owner nurtured the paper until her death in 1972. She also used her fortune and status to promote cultural development in Denver, helping to establish the Denver Center for the Performing Arts. Before we continue, a quick message. Join the Colorado Sun for its 2023 legislative session preview. On January 11th, join politics reporter and editor Jesse Paul as he speaks with lawmakers about the upcoming session. The event is free and virtual. Sign up today at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Hey, Colorado. As we head into the new year, we're visiting with Mark Stevens, a longtime journalist as well as a communications expert and, of course, author of the Allison Coyle mystery series. So Mark really hits to all fields, if I can use a baseball expression, which seems appropriate since his just-released novel is titled The Fireballer. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, Kevin.
So this book is a bit of a departure from the Allison Coyle series. Tell us a little bit about The Fireballer, and what led you to write about a hard-throwing pitcher instead of a detective?
I grew up, in terms of writing fiction, I grew up in the crime fiction world. I really liked crime fiction. I liked the structure of it and the simplicity of it, at least in terms of having a beginning, a middle, and an end, with the mystery getting solved or the killer getting killed or captured, whatever. Literary fiction, I love reading, but it was always sort of daunting to me to think about what that might be or how I would even tackle that kind of a novel. So I wrote five books in the Allison Coyle mystery series, as you said. I wrote a couple of standalones. I had several good agents for quite a while in the 90s and finally didn't get published until 2007. And that's when I began putting out those Allison Coyle mysteries. And just sort of felt myself thriving a little bit in the crime fiction community. Well, it's funny how ideas sort of just drop into your lap sometimes. My good friend, Irv Moskowitz, who you might remember, was the superintendent of Denver Public Schools for 5 years in the mid-1990s. He and I became friends. I worked for him for 4 years. at the school district. And then he took off for some other jobs and we stayed in touch. I mean, he became one of my best friends in terms of thinking about books and thinking about, well, we both loved baseball and we would talk about politics and all sorts of things. And usually it was over a burrito in the park. And this particular day in the summer of 2018 was no different. And he casually mentioned the first half of the idea of the Fireballer. He casually just said, you know, you should write a book about the first pitcher to ruin the game. And I said, what do you mean? And he started explaining to me the physics and the math, basically, of how little time a batter has to swing when a pitcher throws a baseball 105 or 106 miles an hour. At that speed, a batter has 0.3 seconds to decide whether to swing, where to swing, how to swing. I mean, it's insanely fast pitch to try to get your bat around and connect. And he was envisioning a pitcher who could throw, say, 110, where basically it's the end of the game. There is no time left to get that bat off the shoulder and around through the zone. And we kicked that idea around for a while. I didn't know really what I would do with it immediately. I liked the idea in general, but it wasn't a mystery. And I'll end this long story by just saying that that same night, not even really spending a lot of heavy time, like concentrating on the story or anything, the other half of the book just sort of dropped out of the sky. And that question was, well, if that pitcher in particular had thrown a ball in Little League when he was 12, and if that ball had hit and killed an opposing batter, we might have a real character for a book.
Wow, absolutely. You bring up just an interesting thing about baseball and the numbers. And as players have gotten bigger, faster, stronger, they throw harder. And yet in other aspects of the game, think in terms of, say, you know, the bases are still 90 feet away. A ground ball is still going to be an out like 95% of the time, even though players are faster. But you know, I guess the fielders have stronger arms. It's just amazing how the game is adapted in that way. But now you're looking at a way that's, you know, potentially game changing much more than the others.
Right. And I think right now you can see Major League Baseball in general trying to grapple with the issue of pitcher dominance and trying to tweak this game, which is obviously something that with the rules and just how they want to manage how the game is played, you can dial up or dial down certain things in the, you know, they've changed the height of the mound over the years. Next year, they're going to increase the size of the bases to try to get more base stealing going. They're going to ban defensive shifts. And they've been changing the rules for centuries. I mean, back in the old days, I'm talking 140, 150 years ago, the pitchers tossed underhand and batters could ask for where they wanted the pitch to come in.
Well, kind of hard to imagine if it was back in the late 60s when Bob Gibson was thrown off an elevated mound and had a 1.12 ERA, I think. It was pitchers were so dominant. Like you mentioned, they lowered the mound to try to even the playing field, so to speak. But baseball's always had this fascination with stats in general, and particularly with the radar gun and how hard pitchers throw. And as you mentioned, it's kind of an obsession these days. And that reminds me of the 1985 Sports Illustrated story, which I'm sure you saw too, because we're kind of the same vintage, where the famous author George Plimpton did a piece about a guy named Sid Finch, who, according to his story, threw like 185 miles an hour, which, you know, absolutely makes no sense. And of course, this was an April Fool's Day hoax that a lot of people played along with, and everybody else totally fell for it. But your story is grounded in something exceptional, but these days seemingly within the realm of possibility.
Back in the old days, I mean, a batter could walk to the plate and ask a pitcher to throw the ball underhanded to exactly to the spot that they wanted to hit it. This is a game that is constantly evolving and constantly changing. But obviously pitchers, and there are whole clinics around the country where they are teaching pitchers to throw faster and faster. And that's a fact. It's coming. In the last 20 years, the speed of the average pitch has risen, I think it's 4 or 5 miles an hour, which is quite a bit.
So given this kind of scientific statistical element that's so key to your premise here, I'm wondering, did you approach this writing differently from your previous work? I know you're a baseball fan and have a lot of knowledge about it already, but did you have to do a lot of research on this, or could you craft it from what you already knew?
Oh, God, no. I definitely did a lot more research and enjoyed every second of it because it gave me an excuse to read a lot of baseball books and dive into that world, which I welcomed. It was refreshing to go and purposely read, I don't know, a dozen or 15, 20 books, most of them nonfiction about baseball today, and try to capture, what's happening in the game today and how people are thinking about it. It was a lot of fun, different player accounts, just different. I read because Frank Rider pitches for the Baltimore Orioles, I read a great history about the Baltimore Orioles and some of the highlights from their franchise. I read a book about the mental side of the game, and I read some sort of, just sort of philosophical books about it, too. So it was a blast.
So as you mentioned, your protagonist plays for the Orioles, and I can also imagine in the course of research, expensing a trip to Camden Yard for a game or two. Did that figure into the equation?
I thought about that. Unfortunately, the downside of YouTube is everything you kind of need is on YouTube or some way to research almost everything you need. Yes, being there would have been a real bonus, but at the time, writing the book before I sold it, I couldn't really justify that kind of a trip in my mind. And at one point, I contacted the Rockies about possibly coming down to spring training and hanging out with the team and just doing some up close research. But again, I mean, part of it was just sort of thinking, what did I really need to know? What did I really need to understand about baseball teams? I think most of what I needed was pretty accessible, either through reading or through good old YouTube.
And so ultimately, I mean, this really is a human story. Yes, it's baseball through and through, but it's a human story. Did the context of having it in a baseball setting make it a different type of challenge for you or not?
That's a great question. I think it does in some ways. First of all, I think that the baseball novel, you put that in quotes, the baseball novel, there's so much expectation for that. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of great baseball novels. And I think readers both want the authenticity of the game, but they want to see the human story come through it. And they want to see something happen to the main characters through that lens. And because I think baseball just has its feet so deeply rooted in American history, and there's just a special quality to the game itself in terms of no clocks and sort of a pastoral atmosphere to it. It's a perfect sort of palette to work with. It's got the elements you need to have off-field events and issues come into play on the field. And in Frank's case in particular, the thing that is making him so so much the center of the sports conversation, he's the biggest talk in the country, is the very thing that took a life, his ability to throw a ball. So there's that great paradox at the center of the novel.
So do you see this as a standalone, or given how much fun it was to write, is it tempting to think about this as part one of much more to come?
I think if you read The Fireballer, it's pretty hard to imagine a sequel, at least right away, given where Frank ends up at the end of the book. But that's a possibility down the road. I am, in fact, writing another non-crime fiction novel, and this one is set in the world of rock and roll. I definitely wouldn't have been even considering a non-crime fiction novel had I not written The Fireballer. So, yeah. But as far as Frank goes, I think his journey is over, I think.
Well, we've been talking with Colorado author Mark Stevens, whose new novel, The Fireballer, is available at fine bookstores everywhere. And thanks for joining us, Mark. It's been a blast.
Thanks a million, Kevin.
Read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Senate Bill 16 is up for debate in the state legislature this session and seeks to eliminate all of Colorado's carbon emissions by 2050. Sponsored by Denver Democratic Senator Chris Hansen, the bill would also set tough interim goals for greenhouse gas reduction and try again for a 30% tax credit for clean electric lawn and garden equipment. It is unclear how much support Hansen's bill will receive from the Polis administration, which at times has been reluctant to add air pollution provisions affecting private businesses beyond those under consideration by the Air Quality Control Commission. State officials are pulling the permits and kicking out the men who have been running the Never Summer Nordic Yurt system in northern Colorado near Walden. The men, who have not responded to the state notices, have been taking people's reservations and money for cross-country skiing trips but have not opened this winter and are not on site. The Colorado Parks and Wildlife Agency has sent the pair cease and desist letters, and they have until June to remove their yurts and other property from the State Forest State Park area. Midway through this winter, meteorologists remain cautiously optimistic about how much moisture Colorado could finish with this season thanks to an above-average snowpack. That's largely thanks to recent increases in precipitation and heavy snow that have brought much of the state out of drought. The hope is this could lead to a successful wet season and possibly ease drought conditions this summer. But forecasters say the next few months will be key, especially when the wet season starts in mid-February to determine any kind of major drought relief. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. Before we go, we encourage you to check out a new podcast from our friends at KUNC called The Colorado Dream. Here's a sneak peek.
The new season of The Colorado Dream explores the Black immigrant experience in Aurora. It's told through the eyes of one African woman.
I would sit on the beach and just daydream about coming to America.
And the city of Aurora that's working to become an inclusive home for all.
In the last 20 years, we have a new face of the city.
I'm Stephanie Daniel. Join me for The Colorado Dream, Newcomers Welcome. You can find the series at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, a quick message from our editor.
I'm Larry Rickman, editor and co-founder of The Colorado Sun. The Sun is a public benefit corporation, and we rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to produce the nonpartisan, in-depth news that Colorado needs and deserves. Please consider becoming a Sun member for just $5 a month. Learn more at coloradosun.com. Thanks.